All right. Okay, good morning. We're going to get started with the hearing of the Children, Families, Finance, and Policy Committee. I'm calling the meeting to order. We've got a few folks excused, a few members. I think rather than going through the roll as we typically do, I'll just note that there is, in fact, a quorum and ask for a motion to approve our minutes from the March 5th meeting, if I may have that.
So moved. Oh,
actually, I'm going to go. I think Representative Burkle was on top of it. Representative Burkle, you're making that motion?
Yeah, I'll make that motion.
Okay, good. Jumped in front of you, Representative Katisa Tune. And so, members, that's in our packets, and members of the public, a reminder that everything we have is online. Any additions or corrections to those minutes? Hearing none, all in favor of approval of Representative Burkle's motion to approve the March 5th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Motion passes. And that's your first motion, Representative Burkle, and as a member of the committee. Glad to have you. And so now we're moving on, members, with a couple of bills in a bit, but first a follow-up on the discussion that we had on Tuesday regarding the SSIS technology system that's used for child protection cases in our state. This is, of course, a really high priority for our committee and for the public and for all of us, the area of child welfare and child protection in general. And we've heard both on Tuesday, and I've heard a number of other times as well, about the constraints being imposed by the system. So I'm going to ask our presenters to make their way on up, please. That includes Alex Mentes. I'm not sure if I'm saying your last name correctly. Patricia Harrelson, Lori York. And we'll just kind of, feel free to make your way up as well as you want. We can maybe pull a third chair around, or somebody can sit in the back area, whatever works. And then there is, I believe, the presentation in our packets and also members of the public online. So once you're ready, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. Whoever's going to go first.
I guess I'll go first.
Okay.
Hi there. I'm Alex Mentes. I'm the SSIS manager at the Department of Human Services.
Welcome. So glad to have you.
Thank you.
I think what we typically do is the first person going, if that's going to be you, Alex Mentes, then you simply will proceed, and then when you hand to somebody else, they could identify themselves, and we'll go from there. So,
okay.
Yeah. Thanks. Technology being the theme of the day.
I'm not sure how to make this thing go.
Oh, maybe. Well, have you tried the down arrow or right arrow?
There we go.
There you go. Okay, thanks. Please proceed.
Chair Pinto and committee members, I would like to thank you for offering us the opportunity to speak today about this crucial modernization needs for the Social Service Information System, or SSIS. DHS would also like to express gratitude for the $2 million investment last session that's allowing us, in partnership with Minute and the local social service agencies, to do thorough technical assessment and user experience research to inform immediate improvements and a modernization path. This money was provided in the context of the Child Protection Paperwork Reduction Act. DHS is presently leading a comprehensive examination of SSIS data entry requirements and performance problems from the point of view of a child protection worker. This process has so far brought together feedback from 49 local agency caseworkers and 32 child welfare policy staff. Also with this funding, two requests for offer will be published this month that will seek external consultants to do a present state assessment of technical architecture and an assessment that will recommend one or more modernization paths. SSIS is the case management program used by county and tribal social service staff for child welfare programs, children's mental health, adult protection, and other social services. There's also a module that's used to submit Medicaid claims and to facilitate payment for services or placements. Though SSIS is used by a wide variety of programs, it is required as part of our federal Title IV-E program. We must follow federal requirements to continue to draw down federal funds to support the child welfare system. Much of the data entry in SSIS is in some form a federal requirement. You've already heard from MACSA and DHS on many occasions that the current information system has poor performance and excessive data entry requirements. We will outline those briefly, but first it is important to center the reason we are all here today. Investments in a modern information system will ultimately result in better outcomes for children and families. I'd like to give our county and tribal partners an opportunity to share their perspectives.
And actually, before you do, could I just ask a clarifying question? Back a slide, if you can just go up. The reference is the primary function being to report to the federal government on child welfare activities, but then it's described as social service information system paying for social services. Are there programs beyond just child welfare and child protection in SSIS? If you can just sort of clarify that for us.
Yes. The local social service agencies use SSIS as their primary case management system, and then also to do targeted case management reimbursement and Title IV-E reimbursement for out-of-home placements.
So
of all kinds.
Can you just talk briefly about the, but so are there aspects beyond child welfare?
Yes.
I don't understand. Yeah. So what sorts of services or programs are being provided to families beyond child welfare?
Children's mental health, developmental disabilities, elderly services, adult protection, the entire milieu of services that the local social service agencies are charged with providing.
Okay. That's actually a lot broader than I had realized. So, okay, good. Thank you. And then, please. And then I'm not sure who's going next, but please identify yourself and proceed.
So, Chair Pinto and committee members, thank you for allowing me to talk to you today. I am Patty Harrelson. I am the manager of Child and Family in Minnesota Prairie County Alliance, and I'm also the children's co-chair for MAXA. So one of the things that Alex left with was that a newer system would help outcomes for kids and families. How do I know that? Well, because there's a lot of research that says that that is true. So the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services found a relationship between the frequency of visits and the quality of visits between the caseworker and the family, and that improved outcomes in the areas of child safety, permanency, and well-being. So when we talk about our families, it is time spent that matters. So can we get out? Can we work with our families? Can we spend quality and quantity time with them to support them in getting their case plan done? One of the things that I talk about here is really families do rely on a stable relationship between them and their caseworker. And one of the things that I often talk to our staff about is that they can be and are the intervention, because as you're aware, in many parts of Minnesota, there's not services for our families. So I believe that caseworkers can be that service for our families. So that's one of the things. And it takes the process of SSIS and working in SSIS don't allow workers to spend the kind of time and attention with the family that they need to, because they're working in the system. So we basically are working for a system, not for our families. That further creates, you want to go to the next slide? Mm-hmm. That further creates some pain points for our local staff. So we're used to systems that are intuitive. We're used to systems that are logical. So think Windows, think Word, think those kind of programs. When we onboard new staff, we get feedback from them that the functionality is not what it needs to be. There's no copy and paste function. There are many challenges with that system. And so overall, a poor user experience in an IT system like SSIS can lead to frustration, decrease in productivity, and overall negative impact on our workforce. It also does impact us financially. So there's a process in SSIS. It's a fiscal module that we have to complete. That has to do with child welfare targeted case management, which is a significant funding source for county government. The other piece of this is we're unable right now to bill for Family First Prevention Services currently in the system. So we cannot yet seek reimbursement through the system for these services that we're delivering to families. So these are some of the frustrations that our staff have. When they come in and onboard, it's got to be their biggest frustration is the SSIS system. It is incredibly hard for them to manage to work with. So from my perspective as a manager, I see a lot of lost time. They can't get out to work with families. They can't do the things that they should be doing. And so they're spending a lot of time doing what we call time reporting and things in a system that has multiple clicks, multiple processes that just don't work very well for current times, I guess I would say. With that, I'll turn it over.
Okay, thank you so much. Yeah, Lori York, please identify yourself.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Lori York. I'm the executive director for White Earth Nation, and I'm also the American Indian Child Welfare Advisory Council co-chair, and thank you very much for your time today. So the tribes can agree with what Patty has stated, and very similar as far as the duplication of work, that type of thing. The SSIS is not user-friendly. It's outdated. It was not developed in partnership with tribes and families in mind. Tribes have concerns regarding tribal data sovereignty. We have concerns about the Family First Prevention Service Act that will, which is that 4E billing service, the ability to bill and make those claims. And with SSIS, if they use that mechanism to do that billing, that would leave out the other 9 tribes, because there's only 2 tribes that currently use SSIS, and it is not federally mandated that the tribes use SSIS. The other bigger issue with SSIS is that there's so many complexities of when it interfaces, and there's a lot of errors that can occur in that time with the MNSIS and MAXIS system. So anytime that there's those errors, it creates AFGAR's errors, and that impacts how much 4E reimbursement comes back to counties and tribes. So that is where we would agree with one another that it's just a monstrous system. It's outdated and really needs to be replaced. They spent several years adding on and changing different buttons and things like that, but it really is not working for tribes. A couple of examples of that would be that they do not have a suspension of parental rights option versus a termination of parental rights. They also, it's very hard to collect accurate data. And when we're telling our stories about where our kids are at and the locations, it doesn't always match up. So we know that that system is not collecting information in a timely manner and a correct manner, and that really impacts both counties and tribes in that system. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah. And so back to Alex Mintis, I'm guessing?
Yes. Thank you, okay. Chair Pando. So we've identified 3 key categories of needed improvements. That's performance and features of technology, more user-friendly design, and fewer onerous data entry requirements. Patty and Lori mentioned a number of these frustrations. Performance and stability. There's slow screen loading, unexpected system outages, dropped user sessions. Those are common. Critical case information cannot be entered or accessed. Unsaved work is lost. Worker data entry backlog increases. SSIS does not have web or mobile capabilities. Social work and case management are inherently mobile activities. It's critical to enable caseworkers to be in the field to access their information on multiple devices. There's limited interaction with other systems, excuse me, serving the same people. Counties have expressed a need for a statewide child welfare data system. Limited functionality exists to share across counties and tribes. Data exchanges with the courts and the Minnesota Department of Education are new federal requirements. We would like to see modern features that users expect, just like Patty and Lori said. We would like to see autosave, address verification and autofill, customizable reports, electronic signatures, voice-to-text typing. The system must become ADA accessible. As required by federal law, excuse me, a modernized child welfare information system should also be designed for audiences with visual, hearing, cognitive, speech, mobility, and neural disabilities. There are many bugs and workarounds that add to the burden of this system. Workers frequently make notes in other applications and then paste them into SSIS to ensure they do not lose their work. It's difficult to make changes in this system. The complexity and age of this application means that the development expertise lies with very few people. It's sometimes hard to tell the difference between awkward design and too many data entry requirements. And I kind of liken SSIS to a snowball that's been rolling down the side of a mountain for 24 years. It's collected a lot of really good stuff. There's some user-friendly screens for people to enter their data. There's lots of good data for research and evaluation, but it's also picked up a lot of debris over the years. Much has been added. Nothing has been removed. Very little has been integrated or simplified. SSIS screens are not all intuitive. Skilled designers could help integrate components and make the information system a service rather than a collection of policy and good ideas. More resources for professional designers and continuous user experience input are needed. As decision makers who have responsibility for the functioning of the child welfare system in Minnesota, we need to do a thorough examination alongside end users to determine what level of detail is needed to inform policy and casework. Data entry requirements can never be a substitute for quality training and supervision of case practices. We need to ask for more When we ask for more detail that the user finds confusing and unhelpful, the data enter become less reliable. This does not mean systems cannot evolve and seek new information, but that we need to think creatively about how we gather the data in the most efficient manner. It's difficult to modernize while adding new requirements to the existing system. Where are we going? We seek child welfare technology that supports, not dictates, child welfare practice and supervision, that leads to better outcomes for all children, more worker time spent on service provision and less on paperwork, more innovative technology to speed access to information. We seek a system that promotes accountability to families, federal partners, and the public. A system that is built to assist collaboration, continuous quality improvement reviews, audits, and investigations. A recent example is the Ombudspersons for Families requesting direct access to SSIS. We seek to design a system that would allow for hiding confidential data while enabling reviews that will lead to better policy, practice, and equity. We want a system that provides a modern user experience. As mentioned earlier, we want a system that meets the very basic needs of the next generation of caseworkers.
And I should know we'll need to wrap up pretty quick here. I think we're a little beyond our allotted time. So if you can, I know we do the presentation as well, but
sure.
Let's kind of summarize if you can.
So I guess I'll just say our next steps is our most important next steps. We need to obtain funding to get this to get the ball rolling. Everybody knows that government procurement is very slow, hiring is very slow. We'd like to have funding in place so that we can begin development and implementation of a roadmap to get where we need to go. We plan to seek the input of end users, counties, tribes, and the public. So what we seek now is support from our leadership. We seek investment from lawmakers, IT, DHS, and local agencies. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair Pinto and committee members for having us today.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much. And I'm hoping we'll have a good, robust discussion. Before I go to Representative Nelson, who's first on the list, I just wanted to clarify, have you sort of repeat the clarification we did before, because we've been joined by a few additional members. I feel like it was an important thing about the scope of SSIS, that it is, if folks look on slide three, there's a reference to what SSIS is, and a substantial part of it is child welfare. But I wanted members, and I think I'm looking at Representative Hicks in particular, to get to hear this, that it actually is, Representative Hicks presumably knows this actually because of your expertise with DHS, but at least for the rest of us, this is important for me to know, that you're saying that it is actually not just child welfare and child protection, that you mentioned adult protection, folks with disabilities, the services much broader, and could you just repeat again kind of what the services are within SSIS?
Sure. There's actually 30 different programs, but they are children's services, so that would include child protection and child welfare, including some juvenile delinquency, developmental disabilities, elderly services, adult protection, adult services. What am I forgetting? There's the fiscal components to do claiming and reimbursement for Medicaid reimbursable activities.
Okay, good stuff. Okay, thank you. In fact, Representative Hicks probably didn't know all that, but this is helpful to me. So, Representative Nelson, we'll go to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony today and your presentation. I've been hearing from Pine County. I know Representative Hansen has heard from Scott County, and as I'm sure as others, and many of you. Representative Hicks, you haven't been silent on this either. That's a shock to everybody. But this is something that, back in 1999, this was probably a great system. And it was probably cutting edge. And, when we're in 2024, that's 25 years ago. Despite how I want to believe that I just graduated a few years ago, and that was 97, it is getting to be a long time. Especially if you're a teenager, they really look like we're ancient. And that's kind of where the system has gotten. It's gotten old. And I think the analogy of the snowball going down the hill, there's a lot of good information in it, but it's picked up every stick and twig and everything along the way, and it's really made this cumbersome. Hearing the stories from some of the caseworkers and stuff in Pine County, the challenges they have going through a family of four, getting through, nearly almost through, and it goes black screen. They've lost everything. So it takes hours. Well, they want to be with the children, with the families, helping that. So what are they doing? They're skipping their kids' basketball games. They're not going to their grandkids' plays because they're working on the system, because there's also time requirements of when these things happen, when they have to be done. And you can't just say, well, the faulty IT system is, you know, and get the pass to be able to go. Our workers care about our children and families, and this has really become a big hindrance on being able to get their work done. And, you know, I thank you for that. And, you know, I don't know if this needs to get into the governor's budget on as a priority issue or just what this is, but it's not just children. You know, there's 30 different programs. I didn't realize it was that big. You know, there's so many other things that are wrapped up in SSIS, and it really, we need to put this at the forefront. I don't know if every county has it, but I know Pine County, they have one green screen computer. I asked somebody the other day if they knew what a green screen computer was, and they had no idea. But they've got a green screen computer that is only kept for one of the reports that is required under SSIS. And, you know, that's talking about the dating of this program. And it really, you know, Ms. Harrelson, thank you for your testimony and the concerns you share, and as well as you know, the tribal concerns that are there. There's a lot that needs to be fixed, and you know, the Ms. York, thank you for that, and you know, sharing your concerns that the tribes have with this. And it doesn't, there's only two of the recognized tribes that are enrolled into this system, and you know, it does create a lot of issues there, and so thank you for that.
Thank you, Sir Representative Nelson. I did, so I don't know whether it be in the governor's budget. Of course, we are an independent branch of government, so whatever the government proposes, we get to decide what we advance through. Of course, then at the end, there's a lot of negotiating that goes on. But for now, so I'm so glad I'm hearing a lot of support from you for some action on this. So that's good stuff. So we've got Representative Katiza Witun coming up next.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And thank you all for being here and sharing your experience and your expertise working with this tricky system. I just wanted maybe a little bit more detail in terms of whether or not the conversation is that we need to bottoms up create a proprietary system, or if there is something out there in the marketplace that other states or counties are using with great success, and whether or not that would be a possibility.
Thank you.
Who's up? Yeah, Alex Mentis, please.
Right. Chair Pinto, Representative, thank you for the question. We're doing some research on that right now. We have a request for offer out, which is similar to a request for proposal, for a top-to-bottom assessment from a contractor to recommend a modernization path. We've also done our own research about what other states have done. Other states are further ahead than we are in modernization, so that's a good thing that we can learn from them. Most states have not had a good experience when they've had a big investment in one vendor, in a single vendor, to purchase one off-the-shelf product. We're more looking at a modular approach, looking at something that the state could ideally manage with the help of contractors from the private sector.
Representative Katiza Witun.
That's helpful. Just to get a little bit more background of the process and what we're looking at. I also was curious, I mean, you said gathering feedback from a variety of different stakeholders, and you mentioned like the public in general. Because this is such a system that contains such personal information about folks, I'm curious like how feedback from the public would work, and also how we think that would be helpful, since like families aren't really inputting or utilizing the system, and what your thoughts are on that.
Alex Mentis.
Chair Pinto, Representative, thank you. I think when I said the public, I probably mean that there are opportunities for innovation that we're unaware of. I think that there's opportunities for families to interact with this system that we don't know about. We wouldn't be exposing the public to private data. There's, you know, we're only looking for more security in this system.
Representative Katiza Witun?
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much for this. I'm sorry, I was late for a little piece, so maybe you covered this. Last session, we did put quite a bit of money on the Health and Human Services side into MAXIS and MMIS. And so it might be helpful for us to understand how those systems interact with each other or don't interact with each other to help us sort of understand why we have to put money into this system in addition to those other systems. I think sometimes when we spend money in IT upgrades for the department, it gets really confusing about all the different systems that we have and how they interact or don't interact. Would you mind just sort of helping us better conceptualize that interaction?
I'll explain it.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, Representative Hicks. MAXIS and MMIS do interface with SSIS. So, MAXIS serves the economic assistance, MMIS is for the healthcare billing. SSIS interfaces with MMIS to do that healthcare billing. So, we have a stake in all of these systems being modernized, there's no question. If I can interpret your question as to how do you know where to start first, That's a difficult question. It's my opinion that SSIS is the most complicated system. Social work is not black and white. The complexity of SSIS is so extraordinary and the paperwork burden is so big that I think that the investment now is absolutely critical. I think workers really need some relief.
Okay, and Lori York has something to say, and I will say we've got only just another minute or two on this, but Lori York.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. So what I would like to say is with the Families First Prevention Service Act, as it pertains to 4E billing, just highlighting that 9 of the 11 tribes do not have that capability at this moment and do not use SSIS, and a big part of that is because of data sovereignty. So if we had a new system, we could consider those things as we're talking and having conversations about that 4E billing reimbursement because it is a negative financial impact on everybody involved. Miigwech, thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Hicks, anything further? No, okay. And I'm going to ask Jennifer Sommerfeld to come up if you can as we wrap up here. I'm not seeing other names from DHS. Somebody may need to swap out. Oh, and whoever sends those a card, you have a question. Okay, we're going to get to you. Actually, why don't we have you ask your question? Yeah. If you can, we probably are going to need to move on pretty quick. Representative Lesnikar.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you. I can't see you, but thank you for your presentation. I started in the 90s in St. Louis County and also in Lake County. And what you're saying is 100% spot on. And with the workforce situation that we're at right now, without the timely modifications of the system that supports, to Representative Hicks' point and Representative Nelson's point, the counties are the integral liaison and the tribal nation to make sure these all coordinate, to make sure we're efficient, we're effective, that, you know, we have all these systems in place that are not relating to each other. And the technology is there. So it's mind-boggling to me that we are in this place in 2024. It really is. I mean, it's no wonder families are saying I've sent data in 10 times and I haven't gotten anything back. And if you've ever tried to walk through a process with a family, and I have, and Representative Hicks has, this is what they go through every time to do a medical assistance process, child welfare, the list goes on and on. So the fact that this hasn't been addressed for this long, and we have all these new departments, but if we don't have the data and the ability to support the workforce in the fields and the counties to get the data to be able to document the systems that we need for child welfare, elderly, disability service, we are going to be failing Minnesotans. So I think it's a fabulous presentation.
Thank you so much. We do not want to fail Minnesotans. So I'm going to ask a question of Jennifer Sommerfeld, which hopefully we'll get a strong endorsement of. Jennifer Sommerfeld, what is the estimate of the cost for not failing Minnesotans and fixing and having a system that actually works?
Chair Pinto, members, I mean, it's immeasurable if we're not failing families across the board, but
right.
For SSIS.
SSIS, though, I suppose. Yeah. Very politic answer. I have a more focused question, Shira. Yes, yes. So on SSIS, though, that portion of not failing Minnesotans, what's the cost of that?
Yep. So for SSIS, we've been doing work. I know we're bringing on another consultant, and we've looked at other states, but we are estimating right now it would be in the $80 to $100 million range to be able to roll out all of the changes that are needed. I understand from Alex and talking to people people from Minute, we would be using something, and I'm not an IT person, called an agile process to make sure that as something is coming out, we are working closely with our end users to test each module multiple times before it is run live. And that would give us a chance to do what Alex spoke about earlier, to bring things out in modules so that they work right.
But the understanding that that would be subject to the 50% federal Correct. Financial participation, so the cost of the state would be $40 to $50 million.
Correct.
In one-time funds.
Yes.
Okay. So that's the sort of thing we're looking at. And so members, we don't have a bill. So in fact, this is a conversation to inform the rest of our session. But for those of us feeling a strong impetus, that is the cost. And very happy to have continued conversations. It's a hefty amount, and we certainly know that there's a strong need to hear from members around the table. Thank you so much. We should move on, but the continued conversation, really appreciate all of you for your work. And members, certainly be in touch with these folks. This appears to be an issue that is of interest to all of us.
Thank
you so much. So I'm going to head up, turn things over to Representative Katizo Attune. So I'm going to do that.
Members, next item on the our agenda is House File 3671. So Chair Pinto, when you get settled in, you can move your bill.
Thank you so much. And members, this was not the next bill on the agenda, but I was taking Chair's prerogative to get a couple testifiers out of here. And so thanks for your flexibility. I move House File 3671 for re-referral to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. Happy to explain that further. And I do have an amendment, the DE2, which I wish to move at this time, Madam Chair.
All right. Chair Pinto moves that House File 3671 be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. So, Chair Pinto, you can explain your amendment.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and then I moved the DE2 amendment as well. And members, this amendment, let me think. Maybe what I'll do is just briefly explain the bill. So the bill changes the age at which children who commit what would otherwise be crimes be sent to the delinquency system as opposed to the child protection system. The age right now is age 10. It would change the age to 13, consistent with other states. What the amendment would do, we can talk further about that in a bit, what the amendment does is structure statutes to affect that a little bit better. Our terrific staff, led by Ms. Sunderman, worked on that, but also crucially has a delay in the effective date of several years. There's a lot of complexities with making this happen, and directs our commissioners of several agencies, that's on the last page, to work with stakeholders to basically ensure that we have a good process to make this happen. There are a lot of complexities we'll talk about, and so want to make sure we're doing this right. And so that is the purpose of the DE2 amendment. And I'd ask members' support to advance that.
Any discussion to the DE2 members? All right, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, say nay. All right. The amendment is adopted. And so, Chair Pinto, to the bill and your testifiers.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'll ask my testifiers to come on up if you can. And I think, members, I've probably provided enough of an orientation for now. I think I'll have the testifiers speak and then provide a few more thoughts.
Good.
And I think there are some handouts, Chair, that the page has, and so if we can ask that they be distributed as well, that'd be great.
Wonderful. Welcome to the committee. I have Kaylin Steele and Sarah Davis on the list. So please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, my name is Kaylin Steele, and I'm here on behalf of the Legal Rights Center and our partners in the Minnesota Coalition for Youth Justice to testify in strong support for House File 3671. I urge this committee to vote in favor of raising the lower age of juvenile court jurisdiction from 10 to 13. Raising the lower age is a fundamental step towards fostering the needs of young people in a more compassionate and effective way. When we confine children as young as 10 in the legal system, we not only subject them to trauma, but also risk perpetuating cycles of incarceration. At the age of 10, children are still in critical stages of development, both emotionally and mentally. They require nurturing, support, and guidance from families, school, and their communities to navigate the complexities of growing up. Placing them in the juvenile court system not only disrupts this crucial support network, but exposes them to the harsh realities of legal proceedings while reinforcing the false notion that punishment encourages changed behavior. The journey of discerning the difference between right and wrong is a gradual and intricate process that cannot be attained overnight. It requires an ample amount of patience, grace, opportunity, and space to learn, evolve, and make sound decisions. Each one of us has a story of our 10-year-old selves where we acted impulsively based on our emotions. At that time, we may not have been aware of the full ramifications of our actions, but with the passage of time and self-reflection, we eventually arrive at an understanding of the impact of our past decisions. Furthermore, research shows that arresting, prosecuting, and punishing children in the legal system leads to significant trauma, amplifies existing vulnerabilities, and hinders their ability to lead a fulfilling life. By raising the lower age, we signal our commitment to prioritizing support and intervention over punishment. And in all, supporting House File 3671 is not just about changing a law, but recognizing the inherent dignity and potential of every child and ensuring that they have proper resources to grow and thrive. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Steele. Next, we have Sarah Davis. You can introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning with you. My name is Sarah Davis. I'm with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, where I serve as the Director of our Children and Families Division. I'm here today to speak in support of this important legislation. This is a critically important change to align our systemic response to youth and families with scientific research, best practices, and international standards. There's three critical problems with our current system of bringing children ages 10 through 12 into the juvenile delinquency system. First, it's ineffective. Second, it doesn't align with developmental science. And third, it fails to address concerns in the context of the broader family. So taking these in order, it's ineffective to bring children ages 10, 11, and 12 into the delinquency system because in order to have a determination of guilt or innocence, accept a plea, impose a disposition requiring treatment or services on a youth, that child has to be competent. And 10, 11, and 12-year-olds simply are not competent to stand trial. It's not surprising. There's nothing wrong with them. They're just simply too young. This leads to delay in implementing supports and services. What happens is there's an evaluation, they're found not competent, they're reevaluated 6 months later, and this continues in a cycle until they're old enough to be determined competent, and then many times we're talking years after when this behavior occurred. Second of all, it's not aligned with science. Our understanding of youth brain development has grown exponentially over the last decade. We know a lot more now about when and how connections to the prefrontal cortex develop and that this development continues through the mid-20s. Children are not just little adults. Their brains are fundamentally different. In this context, treating children like children means we must intervene with a clear understanding of their lack of brain development and within the context of their family. And finally, it fails to address concerns in the context of the family. So children ages 10 to 12 are deeply reliant on their family systems. Any intervention to be effective has to include this broader lens. And the juvenile delinquency system just simply isn't set up to do that. It's not able to hold families accountable for their engagement in addressing the needs of the child, which is a critically important piece of this puzzle. There have been concerns raised about the ability to place youth in a facility, right? A young person whose behavior is serious and causes risk of harm to themselves or others. It's clear that this can be done outside of the delinquency system, both through a voluntary placement agreed to by parents or guardians or through a CHIPS placement. And I gave you a handout to demonstrate that in Hennepin County, we've actually been doing this for the last year. Since the spring of 2023, when we implemented a new policy that we would not charge children ages 10 to 12, and instead we would use a social service response. So as you look at that, you'll see that there were 152 youth under age 13 submitted to our office since January of 2023. Zero of those youth were ultimately directly referred to CHIPS. We made exceptions and charged four of those youth as we were trying to get this system set up, which quite frankly is why this delayed implementation is critical. And all four were found not competent and ultimately ended up in the county social service intervention bubble, right? And only two of those, yes. So this is not about dumping children into the CHIPS system. We know that system also causes harm. It's about quicker, more effective interventions in the context of their families and improving outcomes and safety. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Chair Pinto?
Thank you, Chair. I'll just note that there are some complexities for the delay in implementation of the bill, but I do think this is a direction that we should go in, and in fact, I think we are an outlier among many other states In terms of having an age that is so low. But in any case, I'm happy to have a conversation. And I should note, I expect that there will be a cost relating to this. So the action today is simply to send it to public safety for their consideration. And then this will come back before our committee if, in fact, this is something that we are advancing. I'm expecting that to be the case. So for now, just a conversation, and I'd love to get to move on to public safety. But with that, we'll have a conversation. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Very well. We'll move on to member discussion questions. I have Representative Zalesnikar on the list.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Pinto. I appreciate listening to this, and I guess I would like your feedback and thoughts on, for the violent offenses, we're seeing things happen at younger ages that typically we didn't see with violent crime. And so whatever those items may be, a thought process of if that child is 10, 11, 12, doing something that's in a violent classification, your thoughts on where that child may be placed? Because what I'm hearing in the state is that we don't have resources for adequate placement necessarily for where what the options are for these children. So I'd love your feedback on your thoughts on making sure that there's a safe place. If this isn't the path, that what's been done isn't the proper path, then what a new path would be that would assure safety and the right programming for these children. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Zalesnikar. And I think as you're aware, I work as a prosecutor outside the legislature and have for more than 15 years in dealing with felony crimes and violent crimes. And so certainly a concern. I will note right now, if we have, as you say, things can happen young ages, if you've got an 8 or 9 year old, they're not being sent to the juvenile delinquency system, right? And so we want to make sure that we're addressing needs as best as we can. We know that when it comes to an 11-year-old, they look a lot more like an 8-year-old than they look like a 14-year-old. And so part of the reason for delay is to make sure that in the case that there is a need, for example, for a secure confinement of some kind, right, that we have an opportunity for that, because that may well be necessary for some children, but to do so in a way that is trying to actually help get the child on the right path. I say as a prosecutor, one concern that I have is victim notification and victim rights, which is not something that's built into the child protection system. We want to make sure that that would be built into this. And that's a challenge right now if you have an 8 or 9 year old. So hopefully actually would make things even better when you've got younger kids as well. So just that's a general comment regarding that, is that we want to make sure that we do this right. But right now we have this artificial age cutoff as well with that.
Representative Zalesnikar, any follow-up? Okay. Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a request. I'm kind of trying to wrap my head around the age change. And is there data that either staff or some, and not now, but later on, that we could get showing the crimes that these younger folks are committing to get them to go to juvenile detention? And then where the violent crimes start. I mean, that's my fear, is if we, some of these kids are very violent, very young, but it'd be nice to have some data to know what we're looking at.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for having some Daniels. And so, yeah, let's see what we can gather. We've got tremendous expertise among folks who've been working on this issue. And so maybe we can do is have them gather that for us and provide to you and all of us regarding some of those statistics and some of that understanding as well. But that's, yeah, good question.
Representative Daniels, any follow-up?
No, that's it. And this bill, I forgot, is it going to be laid over?
We're sending it to public safety.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Pinto, for bringing the subject up to matter, and I know your expertise, as you stated. I just want to push the agenda towards having a focus on emotional behavior adjustments. I work with these youth. I've spent majority of my time in my teens working with younger kids as my first job that had been incarcerated by the time they were 12 years old. And the continuance, and I think about even within our school district and St. Paul Public Schools with Journeys Secondary School, which is, I believe, on the border of our district, we need to find opportunities to fund those emotional behaviors instead of funding the facilities that have no windows for a 10 to 12-year-old, let alone the kids that are 13 and up, that had been stuck in these juvenile detention centers awaiting a hearing. I mean, I visited Ramsey County Juvenile Detention just a couple months ago with our authors in the Senate to see how we're trying to decrease that number and really recognize that we need to focus on the agendas of dealing with trauma. If we look at the numbers of homelessness across the state and how that affects these kids, if we look at the cutting of social services and opportunities to bring nutrition to our kids, the reality is that emotional behavior is going to turn around. So I really want to push towards this committee to recognize and supporting this, going towards the public safety, so that we find those avenues to have more opportunities for folks in the social service work and more structured places to learn skills and for those kids to gain confidence and to have healing. These are kids, 10-year-olds. Let's think about 10-year-olds, 11, heck, even a 16-year-old is a kid. But you know what? By the time you're in high school, you got to figure out how to adjust so that you can get closer to that 18 age so that you're not looking at a adult penitentiary. I want to talk about the 10-year-old limit to 12-year-old. I think that this is a fantastic opportunity for us to focus on, like I stated, funding emotional and behavior places so that these kids can have a second chance. Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair Pinto. And I'm just going to piggyback off that. Many of you know that children's mental health is an area that I'm really passionate about, along with Representative Hansen. And so we need to think about the school piece. But I would also, you know, really ask us to consider, where are the intensive mental health treatments for kids that aren't fitting into our traditional system? We asked the department to give us numbers about how many kids we're sending out of state, and we have those numbers now. And it's very expensive to support children with significant mental health needs out of state. It's really, really expensive, and it's costing the counties a lot of money. So to piggyback on my colleague here, we can't just think about the criminal justice lens of this. We have to think about the mental health lens, because as my other colleague says all the time, pay me now or pay me later, we are paying for it. We're just paying for it in a different place, and we're spending a lot of property tax dollars and county dollars to do it. So just wanted to throw that in there.
Chair Pinto, I'll kick it to you for a final comment.
Thank you. Thanks so much, members. And I just, I totally am grateful for those comments about helping our kids get on the right track, and to these incredible testifiers as well. I know that they have a lot of powerful thoughts in response to some of the points made as well. This is going to be an ongoing conversation. I'm so glad we have this handout, as seeing like this is actually in use in our state's largest county and going really well. Members, I'd ask for your support now to send this to public safety. And then, as I say, do expect this to be back before us as we assess costs and continue on from there. Thank you, Chair, and thanks, members.
Certainly. So with that, Chair Pinto renews his motion that House File 3671 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety, as amended, excuse me. For those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. And Chair Pinto, you are on your way. So Chair Pinto is going to come back and resume the gavel, but I believe next on the list is House File 4406 from Representative Clardy. So come up and get settled.
And as Representative Clardy makes her way, makes her way up front. I will ask, since Representative, because he's with you and has been assisting and chairing, perhaps if you could move to bring House File, I believe it's 4406, before the committee, if you're willing to.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. And Representative Clardy, welcome back to the committee. I think you were with us last year. You were on at least one bill.
Yes.
Welcome back this year. And your bill is before us, and so please present your bill. And I don't think you have an amendment, Representative Clardy.
I do have an amendment.
And of course, you do have an amendment. whatever I was going to say, that was going to be the opposite and be wrong. Representative Teaser-Toon, would you mind moving the A24 amendment?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And members, it looks like this is some pretty technical stuff, and so maybe I'll just see if there's any member questions, but otherwise we'll get the bill in the form the author wishes. So all in favor of approval of the A24 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. The motion passes. Trouble with the gavel there. All right. And so, Representative Clardy, your bill is amended, and here you are. Please present it.
Great. Thank you. I want to thank the chair and every member of the committee for working so diligently to create opportunities for our youngest learners. You are making it possible for me to be able to do this proposal and bring it forward because you are creating an early care and a learning system, an early care learning system. As a longtime educator in elementary education, I can promise you that this bill will make a difference. Today I'm here to present House File 4406. As a supporter of the READ Act, which is primarily focused on children in our grades K through 12, I'm excited to be here presenting ideas for making sure that we have, that we include the earliest learners in the state's effort to improve the reading achievement and outcomes. As this committee knows as well, there's a tremendous amount of brain development that occurs before kindergarten. Anyone who knows and spends time with young children will recognize this as talking or reading or singing or rhyming. This bill outlines a set of supports for those spending time with our youngest learners every day. So that's parents and early childhood educators, child care providers will be getting support through this bill. And it's also going to be building a foundation for kindergartners. I do have two testifiers here today who can dig more into the details.
Okay, not sure who's going first, but whoever, okay. Erica Moss, you can identify yourself, please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Erica Moss, and I work at Think Small. We're thrilled that Representative Clardy has brought forward this proposal. House File 4406 is a bill about building strong early literacy skills in our youngest children to help them be successful readers later in life. It does this by equipping the adults around them with the knowledge and tools they need to support those children in ways that are aligned with what the READ Act defines as evidence-based reading instruction. This is not an effort to push down the K-12 system onto our youngest children. Instead, it is a way to meet young children where they are and in ways that match their developmental stage to get the best outcomes. The bill does this in a few ways. For example, by reviewing the curricula and assessment tools and professional development opportunities available for alignment with the science of reading, and by setting up three pilots. The first, looking at ways of making sure children are getting the right supports at the right time. That's a multi-tiered system of support. The second, a look at different ways of engaging parents in supporting early literacy development at home. We know that's tremendously important. And finally, a look into ways of measuring early childhood program effectiveness in the area of early literacy. All of these efforts taken together will make it much more likely that the state will reach its ambitious reading achievement goals because it will mean that children are arriving at kindergarten with the best possible foundation to build on. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And to our other testifier, please identify yourself. Proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Julia Quandrud, and I am the CEO of Serve Minnesota, our state's AmeriCorps commission. We operate 19 AmeriCorps programs in 78 of Minnesota's counties. I want to thank Representative Clardy for her leadership in championing evidence-based reading instruction for our state's youngest learners. House File 4406 recognizes that age-appropriate pre-literacy efforts that are aligned to the science of reading are critical in our pre-kindergarten settings. Our largest AmeriCorps program, the Reading Corps, also serves 3 to 5 year olds in child care centers and school-based preschool programs through an initiative called Early Learning Corps. Reading Corps and Early Learning Corps are the product of 20 years of partnership with the legislature, the Department of Ed, Minnesota's early childhood ed providers, and the thousands of Minnesotans who have served as tutors. I wish to specifically address Section 3, which calls for early learning multi-tiered systems of support. Early Learning Corps is a multi-tiered system of support program. It supports preschool, Head Start, and child care teachers with implementing these systems in manageable and child-friendly ways. The program provides evidence-based support to both the whole class and to individualized students who need additional personalized attention. We build these supports into every moment of the day, from children's arrival in the classroom to lining up for recess to snack time. Not only are these supports effective in developing literacy skills, they are also fun and engaging, and they support a positive experience for students in the classroom. Rigorous evaluations by NORC at the University of Chicago have found the program to be effective in improving student literacy. And thanks to the support of PNC Bank, we have even been able to add developmentally appropriate evidence-based math supports to our programs. And what we find is that these supports actually enhance literacy and further build the case that multi-tiered systems of support and evidence-based education are manageable and profoundly effective in supporting our earliest learners. We support strengthening evidence-based literacy instruction in early childhood education, and we look forward to continuing to support Minnesota schools and child care centers in implementing these practices. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much. And I don't think there's any other testifiers for you, Representative Clardy, so I'll just see if any member of the public wishes to testify on the bill and then move to member discussion and questions. Members, are there any from anybody? Representative Cotiza-Batun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks, Representative Clardy, for bringing this bill forward. I'm signed on as a co-author. I think it's something that I really strongly believe in, early intervention, right? With the passage of the READ Act for K through 12 education last year, it's my understanding that there are still some discussions on different phase-ins and trainings happening for our K-12 educators. Can you give us a little bit more information on how this fits within that timeline and just in terms of implementation?
Ms. Moss.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cotiza-Batun, this bill is really focused on outlining future steps that can be taken. So starting with reviews and pilots and looking to identify and lift up the best practices for kind of statewide implementation.
Representative Cotiza-Batun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. It's really helpful. I think, you know, we all want to move in the direction of evidence-based instruction, and I think that just with the implementation process, it can be challenging. I spoke with my superintendent earlier this week, and while they're really excited, our educators in Eden Prairie particularly are really excited about the READ Act as a whole, just ensuring that, you know, the pieces, and I think what you said earlier, Ms. Moss, about not pushing down K-12 because there are already so many requirements and our expectation of our youngest learners gets higher and higher each year, it seems. And I think allowing kids to be kids, but also supporting them where they're at and really giving them as much instruction as their little brains can take to get them in the best place to begin kindergarten. I think, and this will definitely help in that.
Thank you, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Cardi. My question is very much in the similar spirit of that asked by Representative Cotiza-Batun, but more focused on the financial and fiscal aspects of not just this bill, but the READ Act more generally with K through 12. And I don't expect you necessarily, Representative Cardi, to have the answer to this question, but we do have a room full of people who probably have access to it. Do we know whether or not the implementation of READ Act has been fully funded by the state?
Not sure who could answer this. Otherwise, we could have, I think Assistant Commissioner Burnham is in the room, so could ask the, I don't mean, sorry to put you on the spot, but they were giving me looks like I probably shouldn't call on them, so. Commissioner Burnham, we'll have you come down. And please identify yourself and proceed to answer the question.
Good morning. Assistant Commissioner Bobby Burnham serves as the Assistant Commissioner for the Office of Teaching and Learning at the Department of Ed. So fully funded, it depends on how you define that. So the READ Act has the resources currently outlined in the READ Act to fund training for pre-K through 12th grade educators. And we are in the midst of getting that training rolled out, as well as some reimbursement for evidence-based curriculum materials if districts choose from a approved list. As many of you may know, Representative Evelson is working on some revisions to READ Act 2.0, which is including some resources to address some of the more challenging aspects of the current READ Act, which is what we're hearing from our stakeholders and districts is around compensation for teachers to take the training. So I believe she's included some funds to support that effort in compensating. The training is a big undertaking for districts. It's around timing and allowing the flexibility needed to take the training within their professional development calendar. Some districts are and have done that, and there is a need for some funds to support that compensation piece. So the department is feeling that the READ Act is funded very well to get the pieces that are currently in the legislation implemented.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that detailed response. In conversations that I have with administrators in my district, school administrators, I would dare to say that they would define fully funded as they don't have to come up with the money somewhere as a school district. And you know, setting that aside for the moment, I would just caution that as we try to expand the scope of what we're doing beyond K-12 into the early learning space, that we make sure that we're providing the resources necessary to cover what we've already committed to before we go headlong into a new direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. Representative Lee. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to offer to the committee, I know Ms. Burnham, Deputy Commissioner Burnham just mentioned Rep. Adelson is working very hard to make sure that we fill these gaps. And I think we can offline about this afterwards, Rep. Hudson, but happy to also share that I believe MDE has already negotiated a state contract for the training. And so, you know, happy to also help you connect with your district and make sure that they know that. So just wanted to also amplify that message from Rep. Adelson.
Thank you so much. And then just one question for maybe for Rep. Clary, just something to raise, I suppose, to the group is just seeing the blank appropriations. Sometimes that's in a program that's really scalable. These seem to be actually about specific things. So maybe Ms. Moss, if you can comment on that, and that'll just be something we'll obviously want to understand as a committee how much each of these things would cost if we would fund them. So Ms. Moss.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The first two sections of the bill are areas where I think a discussion with DHS would help define what the costs are and how those, so this would be like a review of the existing approved curricula and assessment for parent aware, a review of existing professional development to see where the gaps are. So looking at how to partner with the department on that. And then on the pilots for MTSS and parent engagement would be around $1.5 million each, and then the assessment pilot around $500,000. And those are estimates that haven't been worked through with the departments yet, but are based on conversations with experts in the field who would be participating in those kinds of opportunities.
If you could send in an email with those estimates, that's good. Obviously, that's guesses at this point. But as we're thinking through things the next couple of weeks, that's helpful to know. And then obviously, we'll be wanting you to work, and we'll be seeking a fiscal note to understand from the departments, the two departments' perspectives, because there's two departments here, what a cost would be if we were to do this. Okay. Any other questions or anything from anybody on this bill? Just being laid over, not seeing anything. So, Representative Collier, you get the last word on your bill.
Thank you. Again, as a teacher of little kids, this is going to make just a big difference in our children's preparation for entering school. So I hope you can support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Clardy. Thanks for being here. Thanks to your two testifiers. And with that, the chair lays over House File 4406 as amended. The next bill up is House File 4425, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. And as she heads up, this bill is... I believe Representative Hemmingson-Yeager is moving this bill for referral to the General Register. I'm sorry, that could be wrong. So, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, you can.
Thank you.
Being brought before the committee, it's going to be laid over. I think maybe needs a little bit of work before we would send it. Okay, so.
Yes, please.
Okay, good. So, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager moves House File 4425 to bring that before the committee. Apologies for, as usual, messing that up. And then please proceed with presenting your bill.
Thank you. Good morning. So again, Amanda Hemmingson-Yeager from Maplewood and Woodbury.
I'm here today with a bill, much like my style is to keep things concise and succinct. I believe that this bill has a very concise and succinct solution to some of our family child care issues. The shortage of child care is a message we've heard loud and clear. And particularly in my neighborhood in Woodbury, most of our neighborhoods are governed within homeowners associations or HOAs. And I was really shocked to find out that not only in my district, but in other counties as well, these HOAs are forcing the closure of home daycares, which is only exacerbating this crisis. So basically, this bill aims to address this practice, I guess, to allow neighborhoods to provide the child care that we desperately need. I would like to thank my testifier for being here this morning, and an extra special thanks because he had to find coverage for his own child care to come and give his testimony today. So,
my goodness, okay. Thank you. Yeah, thank you. And so welcome, and please identify yourself to proceed with your testimony.
I'm Thomas Leonzel. We own a home daycare in Woodbury, Minnesota. We opened up the daycare in 2011, and we were in a development called Dancing Waters. So we did check with the HOA and checked with the bylaws, make sure that everything was okay. And so 2011, we opened up. My main focus was real estate, and my wife has a degree in teaching, so she wanted to go ahead and open it. Around 2015, 16, in that area, we received so many phone calls and demand for more and more daycare. She asked if I would come and help, and I did. So in 2016, I left my real estate career and helped out in daycare, became trained and that type of thing. 2017, I guess we did such a good job that Washington County made us the home daycare of the year. Mm-hmm. And so Little Stars got recognition, and it was pretty great. Our parents are absolutely happy with us. Well, mid-2019, we received a letter in the mail from the lawyer of the Dancing Waters HOA saying that we needed to amend our 11 students, and we needed to take it down to two students, and we had 30 days to do that. If we didn't accomplish that in 30 days, we were going to receive a $200 a day fine until we were in compliance. That was a little shocking, so immediately I called up the lawyer and said, you know, why are you shutting us down? The answer was, Tom, we are not shutting you down. We're just saying that you can have two students in your daycare. And, okay, why two? Because the state allows us as many as 14, but we elected to do 11, but you're saying two. Why two? Because why? That's what the board wants. Hmm. Well, I explained that we have students that had been here for many years. They built relationships. We have relationships with our parents. What do I tell them? Well, that's not up to me, Tom. You do what you want to do, but you have until the end of the month. Okay. We ended up taking the daycare business out of Dancing Waters, and we moved and got lucky and found a place still within Woodbury, but not in an HOA-controlled community. And those are getting harder and harder to find. So that's our story. It is now 2024, and I've had multiple phone calls from other daycare owners that are falling into the same situation. So
Thank you so much. I was going to turn, Representative Hemmingson Yeager, something you want to add?
Yeah, I just want to add, he had to move across town, which in Woodbury we're getting so big, it can take about 15 minutes to get across town.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for your persistence and for your work and for sharing your story here. Mm-hmm. Really appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah. We'll see if there's any other member of the public who wishes to testify at all on the bill, and then see what discussion or questions. So seeing none, member discussion or questions. Representative Coulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, this bill would apply to HOAs, condo associations, kind of running the whole gamut, correct?
Correct. Okay.
Thank you. And then the other thing, I just wanted to thank you for bringing this forward. I won't use the language I normally use when referring to HOAs because we're in polite company. But clearly there are some really bad actors there, and I think this also represents a kind of sort of common sense regulation work that I think we often talk about in this committee as far as supporting and addressing the issues we have with lack of family child care. So thank you again for bringing this forward, and thank you for your work.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Other members, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hemmingsegan-Yeager, for bringing this forward. And I'll just join my colleague on the other side of the aisle in heaping praise upon anything that restricts the ability of HOAs to gang up on individual homeowners. And, you know, I frankly, if you had brought a bill that hit them even harder in a bunch of different other areas, I would have been happy with that, too. But this is a great place to start. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Maybe we'll keep an eye out for maybe amendments coming in the future. I guess we'll see how things go. Representative Hicks.
So Representative Hudson just triggered something in my brain. Can HOAs restrict foster care?
Representative Hemmingsegan-Yeager would know. And if we have, Ms. Senderman is, yeah, we're not sure on our staff, not sure if anybody in the audience knows the answer.
Oh, we should look into that.
So if we can ask Representative Hemmingsegan-Yeager, you're the author, you have something to say on that?
Yeah, so my only comment would be is my understanding is that these family child cares are being recommended to close or very much restrict their business because they are running a business outside of their homes, which many HOAs have bylaws specifying you cannot run a business outside of your home.
But it's certainly worth looking into Representative Hicks's question. So if somebody watching is aware, if we can get that, that would be good to know. Representative Nelson.
Well, I'll jump on the bandwagon too. You know, I think there's so many small businesses, whether it's a daycare or others, that I don't know what you had for a real estate business to the testifier, but you know, so many of these start out of their home. You know, it's kind of the dream. And maybe it starts out of the home office and eventually maybe has something on Main Street, but there's so many things that start there, and I think that just one of the things that yes, you do want to have protections around a community, but at the same time, I think this really should not be what the intent of HOAs are, and I think I really support getting things. I overall don't like more regulations, but I think this is one that I think I can get behind because somebody else is regulating somewhere else that's causing issues. So
it could be viewed as a regulation that reduces regulations to a certain extent. Representative Katisa-Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hemmingsegan-Yeager, for carrying this bill. This is kind of the tip of the iceberg in terms of, Representative Hudson has alluded to, things that the legislature should take into consideration about homeowners associations and just the overzealous controls that they have on people. And I think, too, Representative Nelson just mentioned, particularly throughout COVID, so many people have been working from home. And we know that there are consultants who our independent contractors who work out of their homes. Where do we kind of draw the line? Just simply because there are families entering the HOA and dropping their children off and then leaving? I mean, it seems kind of crazy that that we would not allow folks to care for children in this way and utilize their space that they pay for and that they also pay the homeowners association fees to be able to live in that space. So I know that Chair Howard on the Housing Committee and then myself and Chair Stevenson in Commerce are considering other homeowners association proposals and certainly would welcome any support and suggestions from members of the minority too.
Thank you so much. We really need to get to our last bill. Representative Lesnikar, you would raise your hand. Can it be real quick?
Sure. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill. With over 1,000 family child care closures in the state in just about a year, year and a half, we need every slot we can and to support family child care. So I'm grateful for the bill
and I'm a big advocate. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, as I say, I was thinking we were sending it out. I think it sounds like maybe a little more work to be done, but Representative Henderson-Yeager, you'll know that you've got some, sure sounds like some pretty strong support. Last words to you.
Great. Thank you so much for the support. Thank you for the comments. Yeah, the work I want to do is I would like to talk to the HOA Association just to make sure that I'm getting everything in good faith. And I've also been talking to DHS, too, to make sure this is not interfering with any sort of licensing or something like that. So that's basically the work that I'm working on for your reference.
Thoughtful policymaking. We appreciate it. Thank you. And with that, the chair lays over House File 4425, but hoping to see that again very soon. Thank you so much. And thanks to your testifier. Thanks for your work.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen, we'll have you head on up. And Representative Hansen moves House File 3856 to bring that before the committee, thinking that there may end up being a cost, and so we're going to have that to look at for now and then bring that again. And so, Representative Hansen, I don't see an amendment, and you have moved your bill, and so please proceed with presenting it.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee. You've heard me talk a lot about youth in foster care, also known as fosters, and the unique challenges that they face in the state of Minnesota. Today's bill is one small but important issue that we want to make sure we keep at the top of mind for our committee and for the public. This bill, House File 3856, is something that we can do to improve a little part of foster's experience in the world. This bill will make sure that we notify fosters and or their caregivers of their eligibility for any applicable Social Security benefits. When a minor is in foster care and eligible to be the recipient of Social Security benefits, they are not notified at this time. So this bill seeks to make sure that any minor over 13, the child's next of kin, the guardian ad litem, the legally responsible agency, or the child's and or the child's legal counsel be notified if the county applies to collect these benefits on behalf of the child. It also requires that these funds be used to provide care to the minor, though to be clear, we are fairly confident that this is already the case for the vast majority of benefits collected on their behalf. Last year, if you recall, we passed a bill directing DHS to conduct a study of how often these benefits are collected on behalf of fosters and how these funds are used. The county survey has been completed with what I understand to be 100% participation, and the final report is on its way to us. And so to be clear, today's bill is just step one. We have a lot more to improve the lives of fosters in Minnesota, but it seeks to keep this conversation at the top of our minds and to begin the notification process while we wait for the final information and report to be completed and delivered to us. I also wanted to add, I received notice this morning that the National Association of Social Workers has extended their support for this as well, but unfortunately did not have time to get us a letter of support and asked me to just verbalize that. And with that, I will turn it over to the new and wonderful Executive Director of Foster Advocates, Nikki, and she will share more about her team's expert input about this bill.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to have you. Full disclosure, high school classmate of mine, it was a couple years ago that we graduated. It was like three or four, I think. And so, yes, exactly right. Exactly. And so, but I'm so glad to have you. And please identify yourself and proceed.
Oh, thank you, Chair Pinto. Good morning. My name is Nikki Beasley, and I'm the Executive Director for Foster Advocates, an organization directed by and for fosters working to improve the foster care space in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in front of you today. Fosters face unique challenges and uncertainties throughout their lives. Often we have experienced trauma and overall instability as a result of entering the child welfare system. Because of this, it becomes crucial to address foster rights, especially when they are eligible for federal benefits such as survivor benefits after losing a parent, or disability and Social Security. The loss of a parent or parents can be devastating for any child. While we cannot take away the pain and trauma of losing parents, as well as the trauma of being placed in foster care, we do have an opportunity, and dare I say, an obligation, to at least inform fosters that their parents thought of them and planned for them in the event of their passing. Isn't that what those of us who are parents would want for our own children? Ensuring that fosters are informed about their parents' Social Security benefits should not only be a legal requirement, it is a compassionate and necessary step. Let us recognize the power we have to advance this bill forward and advocate for Foster's well-being now and in the future. Our foster community would like to see our state do more. This bill in front of us today is a step in the right direction, and we ask you to support House File 3856. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
And thank you so much. Thanks for your work and for being here.
Thank you.
I'm going to see if there's any member of the public who wishes to testify, and not seeing any, and so we'll get into member discussion. And Representative Daniels is kicking us off.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hanson, for bringing this bill forward. I think I mentioned my oldest son is deaf, and he had spinal meningitis at 10 months old. He went deaf at 3 years old. It was until he was 17 or 18 before we found out that Social Security benefits could help pay for his hearing aids. Mm-hmm. So we were not a family of great means, and we were spending about $3,000, $3,500 per set of hearing aids, plus the testing. You had to go from Bemidji to Grand Forks to get tested. And just not having, you know, we look back and say, I wish I would have known about that earlier. So I think this will really help out in the future. And, you know, it's tough when you see your 3-, 4-, 5-year-old out in the front yard, and he takes his hearing aid off. It costs you like $3,000, and he's mad at it, and he throws it on the ground. And hopefully you can find it before it gets run over with the lawnmower or something. Mm-hmm. So anyway, thank you very much for bringing that forward.
Thank you. Thanks, Representative Daniels, for sharing that. Other member discussion or questions? Let's see. Representative Hicks, yeah.
I just want to say thank you so much for bringing this forward. I think the work that you've done and the work that your organization has done is just so incredibly important to really center the lived experience. And so I'm so grateful for this next step. I know this is so important for so many youth. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. I should note, I have a lot of history with this proposal, as Ms. Beasley knows, and Representative Hanson as well, having authored the bill that then turned into the study that we're getting the report back. I know that DHS and the counties have had thoughts about this issue, thoughts divided all kinds of ways, and I don't know that I've heard input about the bill. I don't know if there's folks from either of those entities who want to provide information now. It is being laid over, and so the other option is just if you can make sure to provide to Representative Hanson and to the committee thoughts about the bill as we're figuring out about it. And Representative Hanson, you may have comments about that yourself.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I have been in conversation with DHS, and I know Jennifer Sommerfeld had to run to the Senate, but I do believe there was somebody else here who could speak to it if the committee has questions. But overall, we're in alignment that this is a good first step. We recognize that there are some limitations to SSIS being able to push this information out, and so I will turn it over to DHS's representative to maybe share a little bit more about that as well.
Yeah, I guess since this is the last bill, and I see other names, I'm kind of thinking I'll take advantage of that. And Commissioner, so glad to have you, and please identify yourself, and then if you can provide some thoughts.
Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Barti Wahi, and I'm Deputy Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I'm glad to be here today. DHS is, as you know, committed to working to ensure that all foster children and youth have access to resources they need to be successful into adulthood. We see that this could be a potential opportunity. Currently, the agency is diligently working on the study that I think has been referenced by Rep. Hanson to make recommendations to the legislature about how we could preserve federal cash benefits to best serve children and foster youth in the foster care system. We are currently, as was mentioned by Rep. Hanson, in the process of conducting that survey. We are glad to say that we have gotten feedback from all counties. So I think we're in the process of analyzing that information using it, because we could not pull that directly from SSIS, as that was not tracked in that system.
That was a gap in SSIS, turns out?
Okay. A little bit of a theme,
part of the,
right?
A
little
yep.
bit of a theme.
Okay.
You know, and so we're still reviewing that and testing it, and I think also just checking in with the counties to ensure that information is accurate. And, you know, we look forward to continuing to work with Representative Hanson and the legislature on this issue, and as we have those recommendations, to bring those to the committee.
OK, Can I ask to you, or perhaps to Representative Hansen, or maybe Ms. Beasley, one of the three of you up there, just in terms of how this fits in with, and maybe I missed this, but kind of how this fits in with the study? You know, we're going to get the information back. Is this something that as young people have this information, have the notice through this bill, kind of they'll be able to act on what comes out of the study? Or kind of how should we think about these two things fitting together? I'll go to the bill author first, because your bill, but if you want to send it to somebody else.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah. I think my vision for this is that, one, we see that other states have actually done this pretty well, and so we have some lessons we can learn from other states. There's also some federal conversations happening that we can continue to learn from as well, too. But we know that the youth in foster care need to invest in things like an apartment or, you know, one of the things I personally have thought about is we've talked in this committee and had broad support for the FAME program, you know, and a match savings program. There's a lot of things that fosters could use this money for, but we do want to make sure it goes towards their care as well. And so that's the most important piece. So once we get the study and we know how much money or we know which fosters are eligible for this, I think it's really important to lean on foster advocates and ask what fosters need and how they would like to see this taken care of, but also making sure that we're really, really honing in on this going towards the care of the child in whatever fashion that means. Maybe it's for hearing aids. But I'll turn it over to Nikki to maybe give some more info about most directly how they would anticipate seeing this money used once they have the notification or know where this is going.
Well, because the piece I'm trying to figure out is like the study in theory mm-hmm. will tell us the amounts. I'm trying to figure mm-hmm. out sort of how the notice intersects with the study. Like if we had the study but didn't have the notice, kind of what are we losing, so to speak, if that makes sense. Representative Hansen.
I think what I've heard and what my experience has been is that while we do the study, that's great. We need to know where the money is, how much money, where is it going. But in the meantime, we want to make sure that fosters and or their caregivers are at least notified that they are eligible.
Right,
and that eligibility can then help them plan for future things, such as, you know, buying a car or whatever else the child may need in the future. That's how I see this intersecting, and that's why we brought this bill forward, was because the study's great. We need that data, but also we should notify folks in the meantime.
Yeah, kind of aggregate data versus individual. But Ms. Beasley, anything you want to add on that quick? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I guess I would add that for foster advocates at least, that's the notification is really just one step in a larger process that we're hoping. When we proposed last session our survivor benefits, it included notification, it included there being a trust where young people would be able to access those funds when they transition into adulthood. Mm-hmm. And so there, we had several steps within the bill to be able to have a comprehensive bill, basically, and the notification really was just one step in that mm-hmm. larger process.
Okay. And then we're getting tight on time, so we won't do this perhaps in committee, but just Representative Hansen, have you been in touch with the counties at all and have any input from them? And if not, maybe we'll ask them to send in thoughts that they have for at least for our consideration. But Representative Hansen.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And I can confirm that I did hear from the counties, and they are, too, in touch with DHS. So this is a collaborative conversation between all the stakeholders. And most importantly, I will add, that being led by foster advocates and
absolutely.
The people most directly affected.
Could you get it being right here at their executive director at the testifier table. So good stuff, yeah. Thank you so much. Reverend Hansen will give you the final. Anything else that you want to say in the end of this bill?
Thank you, Chair. Just continued thanks to the committee and to our body for our ongoing support of youth in foster care in these new and innovative ways and continuing to move the conversation forward. These are youth who are in the technically the care of the state of Minnesota. And so being good parents and good advocates and partners with them is something we should all be really proud of.
Thank you so much. And so members, we're expecting to get a sense of cost and have the bill come back before us. Thank you so much to Ms. Beasley especially and to Commissioner Wahi. Thank you, Representative Hansen. And with that, the chair lays over House File 3856. And then I believe that we don't have anything else. And so with that, members, we are adjourned.